with Stephanie Potter as your host. Today, she's going to interview solar expert Jesse Hunter, who believes that the progress being made in renewable energy warrants some cautious optimism. They're going to be talking about the effects on climates from deforestation, biofuels versus wind, water, and solar energy, and you'll be invited later in the program to call in with your questions and comments. I want to say thank you to all KABU members out there for keeping KABU alive and well. If you're not a member but would like to become one, please go to KABU.fm and click where it says Donate Today. And I thank you in advance for taking care of that. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic ingredients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral Eco Brew Pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And here comes the Recovery Zone.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show where we focus on healing our world. Today, we're focusing on climate change. And while the problems are still tremendous, my guest today is also going to be talking about some new reasons for cautious optimism. My guest, his name is Jesse Hunter. He's a solar expert, and he's going to be able to talk to us about how renewable energy is making sense not only for the environment, but also in terms of efficiency and economics. And I have Jesse on the phone right now, right?
Hi, Steph.
You're there. Great. Okay. And I'd just like to welcome you to KABU and see where we're going. And also, maybe in a bit, listeners could be calling in. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. Just share your thoughts, comments, and questions with us. So, Jesse, just to get started, I would like to start with this whole idea of cautious optimism. I've actually read that news recently that CO2 emissions flatlined last year. And we had you on the show about it last year sometime. And you at that point were talking about it being a tipping point. And as I've talked to you more recently, you're saying we've crossed the Rubicon. So I'd like to just talk a little bit about what that tells us.
Right. So in terms of last year's program, we titled The Race of Two Tipping Points. And that refers to the idea that we have a positive tipping point and then a negative tipping point. The positive tipping point is that renewables have now proven themselves as the most reliable source for future energy. And in the past, they were considered unable of powering the world. And now we clearly have demonstrated that that argument is gone. Solar and wind in the United States last year comprised 53% of all new electric capacity, generating capacity in the U.S., and that is going to be continuing to expand this year in the U.S. and globally. The other tipping point is the negative tipping point, and that is on the crisis of climate change and degradation of the environment. Those tipping points are also still accelerating. Now, the cautious optimism that we referred to is the fact that for the first time in over 40 years, last year, global emissions ceased to increase. This is unprecedented, and we basically saw they stood at about 32 billion tons last year of CO2 emissions. Now, just to give you an idea of what that means, according to the IPCC, they have determined that we have essentially a carbon budget of about 500 billion tons before we will then exceed 2 degrees Celsius of increase in global warming, at which point they are concerned that that is going to lead to runaway global warming. Now, that is an estimate. It could be actually a smaller budget than that, but that is the working budget that we now have in international agreements. Later this year in Paris, there will be an effort to make international agreements to make further commitments to addressing this. So if we burned 32 billion tons last year out of a carbon budget of 500, so that tells us how many years approximately we have left to burn.
Yeah, that means we have like 470 billion tons we can still burn, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah, according to that model.
Right.
Now, that may be, it might be much less, and there are predictions that, are constantly being updated. So it's hard to know, but that's the agreed amount that we have so far. That we have actually not increased. We've been increasing every year, especially over the last 10 years with the economic growth in China, which has allowed for the greatest increase of people into the middle class, hundreds of millions of people, which is a good thing in terms of the quality of life there. But, of course, it's been at this great cost in global emissions. So now we have, for the first time, we had a 3% increase in global economic growth, and yet there was no increase in emissions. And a lot of this is due to the increase in wind and solar, which the world is quickly investing. So last year saw a 16% increase in clean energy investments, about $100 billion in wind, $150 billion in solar, $50 billion in energy efficiency.
And how does energy efficiency then actually compare to fossil fuels at this point? I mean, how is that working?
Energy efficiency is things like making buildings less energy consumptive and industry less energy consumptive, transportation and so forth, agriculture. That is an important investment. I do want to go to an issue. There has been over basically an argument of whether it's more important to invest in energy efficiency versus renewable energy. And I would say that is, first of all, it's a false dichotomy. We need to be investing in both. But at this point, we are seeing great gains from wind and solar because of their drop in cost over the last few years.
And that drop in cost, that's just continuing to accelerate too, right?
Right. So over the last 10 years, we've seen essentially the cost of solar, for example, come down 80%. And it's continuing to go down. Right. We've over the last 30 years, you could say it's come down over 1,000%. And it's already at what is called grid parity. So that means that solar and wind are less expensive than new gas and new coal and new nukes in more and more regions around the world. And this is making them quite competitive. For example, in Minnesota last year, a judge ordered that solar would actually be allowed to compete against a gas-fired plant, and it just beat it on price. The lowest cost solar now was about 5.5 cents in Saudi Arabia. Wind, and that's unsubsidized. So coal is approximately 6 cents, and coal does not have to account for all of its externalizations.
Right, so I was just going to talk about that. The costs of actually the harm that it's causing, the health issues that it's creating, that kind of thing, none of that is coal paying for, right?
So, and again, referring back to last year, Mark Jacobson pointed out that the healthcare costs from fossil fuels essentially account for about 3% of the GDP. So this is from asthma, cardiovascular disease, and then premature death, lost days of work. So as we switch to clean energy, we get a compounded benefit because not only are we now they're less expensive just on today's market without the cost of these externalizations. If you then consider that they will also have the benefit of reducing these environmental and health-related stresses, it's just every dollar invested is going to have a multiplying effect in the economics of it.
And there seems like the, as you were saying before, like these places where it's starting to go in. I saw a headline: Costa Rica was powered with 100% renewable energy for 75 straight days this year or last year, and Japan can now beam solar energy from space. Or there's a place in Alaska where called Kodiak, where 75% of their energy now is wind power. It's like there are a lot of places are actually making this work for themselves, right?
Well, so a lot of European countries, like, for example, Denmark, that has achieved on certain days 70% of their energy is coming from wind and solar. Now, in terms of Costa Rica, you mentioned that. I should say that that was largely hydro, which has benefits to some degree, but we don't want to rely completely on hydro. Hydro is an important part of the model because we, first of all, now because of global warming, we have less storage in ice packs, so there is a need to actually just store the water. But in terms of energy use, because of drought now and a destabilizing climate, it's going to be harder to predict a reliable amount of water in our reservoirs. So the more we can depend on wind and solar, these will actually stabilize and allow us to predict our energy supply greater than a complete, for example, in Costa Rica, where it's largely hydro there.
But Nicaragua is another place. Fierce winds, tropical sun, tumbling volcanoes. Apparently they want to go for the renewable energy more in terms of those.
Every country right now, Latin America is having a large increase in investments in wind and solar. And this works everywhere in the world. Even in Alaska, you can install solar. Obviously, it's going to have a greater production in sunnier climes. But there is, because there's wind and sun everywhere, this is a resource that any location can utilize.
And which would be, I think I heard you say at one point when I was talking to you that rooftop solar, like I had this idea, oh, if we all put solar on our roofs, then we're covered, that would deal with it. But that, you think actually that wind would be the more really dealing with everything?
So the plan that Mark Jacobson has put out, and I would like just to refer everybody to his one of his websites that he has. It's called The Solutions Project, and that shows a map of the U.S. and then a portfolio for each state that lists here's the percentage of onshore wind, the percentage of offshore wind, rooftop solar, commercial scale solar, and so forth. And again, it's 100% wind, water, and solar is the title of his plan. And rooftop solar, they've done the analysis to show that we can get perhaps at a maximum about 10% of our total energy needs, not just electricity, but this is the idea is that we convert, we essentially electrify all of our economy to electricity. And so this would be transportation, industrial processes, heating, cooling, and what we now use for electricity. So about 10% can come from rooftops, covering parking lots with solar. This should all be done, but a certain amount is going to have to come from utility-scale projects, which are still considered distributed energy because they're smaller individual machines, essentially.
Distributive energy being where the individual is more like a part of it than a great big massive company is making it happen?
Well, there's still a place for large-scale, you would say, owners of power production.
Okay,
so, right,
yeah. Yep.
So
great big solar things happening in the desert, or big wind farms.
That's right,
that kind
of
thing.
And big, yes, both of those. Now, there are drawbacks to any kind of industrial infrastructure, but it's really comparative. So we need to look at what are the drawbacks versus the benefits. So with utility-scale solar, for example, in the desert, there is a significant impact on that environment. So there should be a prioritization of, for example, you start with the most degraded lands first. And my favorite that is probably going to be essentially a second generation of renewables is offshore wind, because it has the least impact on the environment per unit of energy delivered. And now they're developing floating wind turbines where they can be dozens of miles offshore in deep water. They're not embedded into the ground, but they're floating, they're anchored, and it's further away from where there is more marine life and bird life. So they have less visual impact if people are worried about the views. And essentially you could put the wind turbines all along the coasts of the entire world. The U.S. has about 54 gigawatts, which would be essentially about 30% of our total energy needs. Now, we can currently, right now, onshore wind is far less expensive than offshore wind, but offshore wind is coming down in cost. So I would suggest that, you know, our first efforts here should go with the least expensive, because they are the most competitive against fossil fuels.
Right. I just want to let listeners know I have Jesse Hunter on the phone from California, solar consultant, passionate about renewable energy. And I'd also like to let the listeners know you can call in if you'd like. Call us here at the studio with your questions and comments. The phone is 503-231-8187. And so basically, Mark Jacobson's plan would probably, if he could really, or, you know, if he could influence the whole world to make this happen, he actually believes this could happen in 15 to the maxed out 35 years, right? I mean, this is, he believes, and you believe, totally doable within a time frame that could actually help us survive.
Well, so the number of wind turbines for total global energy needs is a very small percentage of our global manufacturing capacity. For example, we're building about 100 million cars every year, and if you look at that level of manufacturing, we're talking a couple of hundred million wind turbines would do this. Now, these are large wind turbines; they're much larger than a car. There is still there's steel, there's concrete involved in these, so there is intensive energy resource dedicated to this manufacturing, but it is not unfeasible. We have the materials to do this. We have the rare earth material to do this. Some recycling may be needed, but it is definitely within our current capacity. We have there's no further innovation that is necessary for this plan, although that will certainly happen and just make it much more affordable and efficient.
Yeah, it really does seem like the innovation is accelerating. Like, I saw this thing where they're even making now solar sockets and solar windows, some funny little solar thing that you can just put on the mark, plug in things to solar, and it attaches to the window with suction cups and just, you know, powers a lot of stuff in your house. It's just so many things are going on every time I look at the computer. But the deal is, it seems like people still are resistant or don't get it, I mean, especially in America. And how do we get past this?
Well, so there is part of the, what I would say, crossing the Rubicon. So last year, there's been a lot of debate, you know, over the years, that wind and solar just can't do it, even from green environmentalists who are now concerned about global warming, but are worried that we just won't pull it off. And we have shown that that will happen now. The economics are all completely in favor of wind and solar. The investments are growing while fossil fuel investments are declining.
Right, like coal has gone down, right? It's like, and it, some of them are threatened with bankruptcy.
Coal is crashing. So, of course, fracking is crashing. Part of the reduction in the oil price has essentially made extreme forms of energy production unprofitable. So oil now is under $50 a barrel. That is less than the cost to produce oil in the tar sands. And, of course, Arctic drilling, which is now more available because of the loss of sea ice. So luckily, that low price in oil is preventing or making it uneconomical to go after these more extreme forms of oil. Also included is deep sea drilling and forms of fracking. Fracking has now, a lot of it is collapsing. So, of course, it's also expanding in other areas, but these will be challenged as wind and solar start to replace new energy, including nuclear, too.
Yeah, but back to, like, here we are in America. There's the organization, what is it, the American Legislation Exchange Council, ALEC. I guess it's funded by the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on to sort of block these kinds of things. They work on legislatures. Could you talk about, like, the kinds of stuff that ALEC is doing to, like, keep this stuff from happening?
Well, these are, in a sense, you could call this old money that just doesn't want to lose their investments, and, you know, that's perfectly understandable in terms of basically people looking out for themselves. They are in the defensive at this point, right now there's of course a divestment movement, and a lot of the arguments have been that divestment doesn't help with reducing CO2, and those are really, in my view, I'm thinking that this is now essentially covered because they know that this is essentially crashing. There's just no way that we're going to continue burning all this. What we're seeing is that we can only burn about 20% of the known reserves. We have about 2,500 gigatons worth of emissions left in the ground, or in the ground right now.
Gigatons, and you were talking about 500 billion being the max that we could go.
Yeah, so we can burn about 500 of the 2,500, according to the IPCC, 2 degree global warming, and at this point, we may not even burn that much, I'm hoping. And that's just because all new energy here in the next few years is going to be from wind, solar, and geothermal. There still is some growth in different regions. There's a lot of push to make this happen. And luckily, people are stopping it on the local level and in the legislative levels. And, of course, we are seeing, you know, kind of Alice in Wonderland type of arguments in the Senate, where you have folks like Senator Inhofe throwing snowballs in the Senate. It's,
yeah. We do have a caller. Phil, are you on the phone?
I'm here.
Great. What would you like to add to this?
I want to add that we could accelerate the introduction of solar by dealing with it as a disaster preparedness issue, that when the grid goes down, we lose our electricity. And for crucial electronics, lighting, so we could continue for that month when we're without power after the earthquake, to live and help our neighbors. If every house had an inducement to provide a low-cost solar array and LED lighting and electronics, everything that should run off of DC to stay SDC. And I think that we could get a big bite on what solar can do that's democratic, that serves everyone, not just the wealthy. And I think then that introduces other possibilities. Every person then has a taste for what they can accomplish, and then they'll go on and fix their houses. What do you think?
Yeah, sort of like once people get, I read somewhere that once, like, say, a neighbor puts a solar roof on, then other neighbors start doing it because this first neighbor is just so happy and telling everybody how great it is. It's that kind of thing. Just spread the word by getting it out there, right?
Right, but it's more than that. Right now, we don't have really profitable return for putting PV on our roof to serve the grid. We don't get much money back,
right?
And it doesn't protect us against disaster.
So
and it's not democratic. It's subsidized for just a few people. And what SolarCity is doing is kind of criminal.
What do you say about that, Jesse?
Okay. Well, I guess I'm a little confused. So I, you know, in terms of a technical solution, every roof that can have solar should have solar. Currently, there are limitations in how much solar you can have on your roof and put back onto the grid. So whatever the market mechanisms are, they need to facilitate this this aim. And in terms of having third-party ownership, yes, there's a lot of concern that the benefits are going to someone else rather than the homeowner. But in the big picture, in general, an electrified and renewable grid with both localized, and again, that's a relatively small part of this overall picture, that should happen, and it should be done in, I would agree, the most democratic ways. Leases have had have allowed for a great expansion of solar installations in the country because it doesn't depend on a federal tax credit for the individual. And that's basically just responding to what the existing policies are. So as the policies improve, this will allow a greater uptake of these technologies. And that's dependent on people calling for greater policies from their representatives.
What about community solar gardens? I read something about that. How does that work? Because they're starting to take off.
Yeah, that is improving. And in a sense, you could also mention in relation to that the whole concept of microgrids. So at a certain point, you know, right now with some of the barriers to this, we are seeing from utilities that there is resistance to wind and to solar by individuals because it essentially is taking a bite out of their
profit.
And I think there is a question on what is the future of a utility. Just recently, New York passed legislation that will essentially redefine what a utility's function is, rather than just being the supplier of energy from large centralized power plants down to the smallest wires in your home. Now they're going to start to be more managers of a bidirectional grid where you have many different inputs coming from sources, and they are providing a service for maintaining this. And in a sense, you could, you know, there's also the whole concept of the utility death spiral, because solar and wind are so inevitably coming that utilities can either resist it for as long as possible, but eventually they won't be able to. So if they're changing their model to be more service-oriented, then fantastic. And if not, then, you know, it's what's that bumper sticker say? You know, lead, follow, or get out of the way. And maybe they'll just be bought up by and become a public utility district.
Sort of like the way so many things are getting that, tool libraries to car sharing to things are getting more and more and more where people are kind of just down to doing, you know, individuals working together as individuals making it happen as opposed to a great big thing organizing it all.
We need both sides. I mean, this definitely comes from market influences. It certainly has its role, and national policy has its role, and individuals certainly have their role.
But I'd like to also talk about, like, the job thing with
sure.
Renewables. How is that working?
So solar jobs, it's just some of the best news that you can find in the economy. They've been increasing. Last year they increased by about 20%. We're going to be approaching 200,000 solar jobs in the U.S. Next year. And this is, I would suggest, you know, if you want a reliable career, solar is a great place to start working. Most of it is in installation, and then there's many supporting roles for that. So it's really positive news on the solar jobs.
So you see the jobs, and you see the jobs increasing constantly with this.
That's right, yeah, because we're at such a small level of the market, and we need to go much further, and we are going much further because we have to. That is certainly the way of the future.
Well, I want to again let listeners know I'm speaking with Jesse Hunter. He's a solar expert. He's also really passionate about renewable energy, and this is KBOO Portland, and we're the Recovery Zone. We're talking about how we can really get this to start changing. You mentioned earlier, Jesse, that you see that it should be strictly renewables, not even like biofuels or nuclear or hydropower. Hydropower is renewable, but there's limits because of droughts. But what about the other two, biofuel and nuclear?
Okay, and we can address hydropower here. But yes, so for example, in Oregon, there was a recent bill that called the Clean Fuels Program, and that is intended to increase the use of biofuels. The problem is that for the delivered unit of energy, it will require tens of thousands of times more water use per unit of energy than would, wind that was powering an EV. So there's other issues with that, just in terms of land area. Biofuels basically are about 1% efficient of the sunlight, so over a given acre, compared to solar, which is about 20%. So you would be better off actually laying out solar panels rather than planting biocrops. Now, the legislation does allow for investments in electricity, so I'm hopeful that while there were, legitimate complaints from various sides of the debate, there is an opportunity for this to be redirected, not towards biofuels, but away from biofuels and towards electric EVs. There's also legislation in Oregon that would allow for a tax credit for EVs.
Electrical vehicle.
That's right.
Right.
And other issues with biofuels is that they're essentially replacing food crops. And that is a huge issue on a national scale and on a global scale. We are essentially looking towards a future of perhaps increased desertification. We're seeing a great increase in desertification in China. Last year, in Russia, they lost about half of their wheat crop, which is about 40 million tons of wheat were lost because they had a heat wave of 14 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
Above normal. And so to be investing in fuel instead of food, it just doesn't make sense. And we can see that from last year. There's basically a declining investment in that. So, however, EVs are growing quite fast now that the technology for the battery is really improved to the point where it's competitive with fossil fuels. So, for example, there's a company, BYD. It's looking to be a competitor with Tesla for battery electric vehicles. They have a bus that costs about 20 cents per mile. It does a charge on 4 hours, can go 170 miles.
Wow.
The New York City is now having several of the buses as a test program. And one of the big advantages is that there's no emissions. So when you drive behind, or say you're riding your bike behind a biofuel vehicle, you still get carcinogenic and particulate matter and other issues that you're breathing in. It is not a fun thing to breathe in. Whereas an EV, there's no zero emissions. So there might be an argument that it is replacing petroleum, and that, however, there's still petroleum used in the production of the either corn or soybean. Most of it is now corn, and most of which is GMO, so there's concerns about GMO and the pesticides used for that. A recent article came out from the World Health Organization saying that glyphosate is almost certainly carcinogenic.
Glyphosate is what they put in Roundup, right?
That's right.
Right, yeah. And so, and that is actually built into the GMO corn.
Right. And my deeper concern about GMOs, just as a side argument, is that it's a patent. So it's kind of like taking somebody else's work, 10,000 years of agricultural seed breeding, and putting your signature on it, and now it's yours. So that having a patent on life is already problematic, but now for you're basically copywriting the world's food seeds, that's dangerous. It's essentially exchanging Exxon for Monsanto.
Right. And also the whole water thing, like I guess biofuels use a lot of water. Nuclear power also uses a lot of water. Water is becoming more and more a scarce resource as we're dealing with droughts. And you're saying solar and wind do not use very much water at all, right?
Right. There's some in the manufacturing process, the way it's done now, of course. But, yes, nuclear and coal, natural gas, these all use a tremendous amount of water in the cooling cycle.
Fracking uses water. Yeah.
Fracking uses water in two places. First, in the energy production, by making a gas turbine, you need water to turn to steam, and much of that water is then released into the atmosphere. And so currently, for example, in California, about 20% of the water use is for thermal plant cooling. And but on the front side, of course, you have fracking, which is also the way that it's being done now. It pollutes the water, and they talk about it. Well, it's only 1% are these chemicals in the fracking wastewater. Well, we normally measure contaminants in the parts per billion, so it's actually quite a tragedy. We have just came out in California in the Central Valley. There are thousands of wells that were illegally pumping their wastewater into the water aquifers in a time of extraordinary drought. NASA is predicting essentially California is looking forward to effectively endless drought for the rest of the century, and increasingly so. So this is a great place where we can save water by moving away from gas, moving away from coal, and towards wind and solar, which use zero water in their actual running. So just some in the manufacturing process.
Yeah, it just, again, it just makes so much sense. I mean, just somehow getting the whole planet organized around making these changes. I want to also let listeners know, please call with your comments or questions. The number here is 503-231-8187. Another big factor with climate change, to go off a little bit with the renewable thing, is deforestation. And I just was reading that there's only two really intact forests left on the planet now. That's in the Congo and the Amazon. And almost all the rest of the world's forests have an edge of a half a mile is as far as it goes in any direction. That's 75% of our forests. Deforestation is a factor in climate change, right?
Yeah, I've seen numbers that are showing that between the burning and just the change in the land use, that it's up towards 20%. So by halting that, we can do a lot in reducing our risk for catastrophic climate change, or shall we say runaway global warming. And actually, if we change some of our farming practices, we could even start to replant much of this And then that way, we're not only are we creating a carbon sink, which will absorb some of the carbon, it's not a huge amount, but it is an important amount. IPCC has estimated that through a rigorous reforestation, we could essentially take about 100 gigatons out of the atmosphere over the next 35 years, for example. So it's just another argument of the really unwise policy of turning forest into energy for cars.
Biofuel, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
And part of some of those solutions, they're permaculture. People talk about that a lot. And
yeah.
Also vertical farming. How does that work? And that saves water again, right?
Okay, yeah, so both those are really wonderful tech. Well, I would say permaculture is essentially utilizing land in wiser ways. It's still agriculture. Vertical farming is a high-tech form of food production. And just in the recent last year, basically in the last year or two, has it start to crack the code on making this work. So now with the lowering cost of LEDs, this is indoors. So, for example, in Japan, they just built in a warehouse that's 25,000 square feet. They're able to produce 10,000 head of lettuce every single day. How it works is there's a company called Aero Farms that has a great system where you have a tray. There's a micro cloth that is stretched over the tray. They put seeds on the top, and then underneath there's essentially a mist of all the necessary nutrients that go into food. Zero pesticides, zero herbicides. Uses about 10% of the water compared to normal agriculture, and then the LEDs are hovering over or are placed over this tray, and you can have about 15 stacks of this in this area, and so it just has benefits in many ways. It still has some. It's coming down in cost. It still is trying to find whether or not it's. Fully profitable, but as it expands, it will become more so. And this is something where you can have it in the city itself, whether it's next to a school or just supplying all the green leafy foods for the urban area. And you don't have the transportation costs and no soil, no fertilizers and so forth. I would say petroleum-based fertilizers.
Right. We do have a caller again. All right. Yeah. Mike, is Mike there? Okay, never mind.
And just to mention about permaculture, the basic concept.
Okay. Let's get Mike on. Mike, was your question? Then we'll go back to permaculture.
Oh, okay, cool. Permaculture. I'm interested. It's just. Energy generation class on the coast. We did a lot of Google search this last quarter, and we started looking at horizontal wind turbines. And I just really think that there's a huge future in that because
Mike, you're kind of cutting out. Could you say that again?
Horizontal wind turbines.
Mm-hmm.
And vertical wind turbines, basically you can take a design and you can shunt the wind right into kind of a Venturi tube, and then you can use that to augment the wind generation, and it just like it's a no-brainer. And I wonder if more people haven't done that.
Hi, Jesse, do you know about that, Jesse?
Hello?
I'm sorry, I'm not quite hearing the question fully. I'm hearing about vertical, perhaps, versus horizontal wind turbine.
Slow, maybe some distance, but vertical wind turbine, the potential for them and Venturi tubes, you can shunt the wind into a kind of a small slot, and then you can use that to augment the wind energy generation, and it just
as a design, it looks like it's a no-brainer, and I'm wondering why more people are doing that.
Have you heard of that, Jesse?
You know, I'm not certain what the caller's referring to. I will just say, you know, in general, we can let the market work its, as they say, work its magic in finding the most efficient designs for different locations in different scenarios. You have different wind speeds onshore, and, of course, there's different wind speeds offshore. They are experimenting with both designs, horizontal, vertical. There's also several different types of, you could either say, aeronautic wind. So, for example, there's one that essentially is like a kite that is on a line that then is flown about 1,000 feet up, and so you can have higher wind speeds at a higher rate. All these designs are, you know, basically innovations on the basic concept of capturing the wind, and they were all developed, and they're all in process. More R&D should, of course, go into that. But the ones that we have now, the least expensive wind, they are based on a very old design. If you look at the wind turbines from the 80s, they essentially are just smaller versions from the ones that we're seeing in going in today. Another design that I actually like is from Professor Seamus Garvey in England. He is looking at huge wind turbines where instead of creating electricity directly, they create compressed air by when you lift up the blade, internally there's a chamber that allows for a piston to drop down just through the use of gravity, creating compressed air. That compressed air then goes into a essentially an expandable balloon that is underneath in the water that is held down by ballast, and that creates compressed air storage, and therefore you can have dispatchable wind. Now that's still in development, but it they've made progress on that. So that again might be second generation wind, but it's for deep water, offshore, far offshore, very large scale. And the advantage of doing it that way with compressed air directly is that you can scale it up. With current wind technology, a lot of the cost is in the torque. So as the wind diameter or the wind blade diameter gets larger, say you double the wind span, you increase the total area of coverage by four times, but you then increase the torque by eight, and torque is what you pay for.
Uh-huh.
So that's one of the reasons why there is currently a limit on how large these can scale, but of course they need to scale because there's a reduction in cost. And so there's innovations in that, and also in how these are mounted. So with floating wind turbines, currently they're using essentially offshore oil rig technology, but they're also working towards having lighter weight that use much less steel and therefore have less energy intensity during its life cycle.
Just to let listeners know that you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone. We're focused on healing our world. We're talking to Jesse Hunter, solar expert, renewable energy expert, who's got some cautious optimism for us. And we have Paul on the phone. Is Paul still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Hi. What would your question be?
Well, yeah, great show. I came in when you were talking about the fracking, and I love the solution kind of based thinking of your guest. Fantastic.
Right. Did you have a question?
As your guest's opinion on the kind of the why of you were talking about Shell before, and of course the always answer is greed. You know, these people want all this more money, but still they got to have some place to spend the money. So what is this this evil that drives these guys? Are they really just like robots or aliens behind the scenes calling these shots, getting us to destroy our own planet? You know, what's going on?
So, yeah, maybe I've heard of rumors that they're essentially working for the lizard people, perhaps trying to warm the climate. I have no idea exactly what motivates everybody. Obviously, there's certainly a natural habit to, in a sense, hoard, all of us, you know, when we're threatened with things, we might be incentivized to hoard even greater. But obviously, it takes wisdom to see past that. It takes wisdom to plant a tree that you'll never sit under the shade of. We are all in this together, rich or poor, whether you're part of the 1% or the 99%, as they say. This is something where we all breathe the same air, and one of the key elements to solving a lot of these problems is, for example, poverty reduction. When people are poor, they tend to have more kids. Overpopulation is certainly an issue, and the best way to solve that is through female education and empowerment. Women currently own about 1% of the property in the world. That is, in a sense, you could look at that as one of the root causes of this mindset of us versus them. And perhaps because we are at such great tipping points, there is a developing compromise, you could say. So it's possible to be rich and yet not harming your neighbors. One of my teachers in music, he made the point of, if you're to be a great soloist, you also have to be a great accompanist. So this is applied to the whole concept of, is it better to get ahead than to get along? And in essence, in order to get ahead, you have to also be skilled at being able to get along. People should be enriched for added value, but not extraction of the health and happiness of others.
Extraction is huge. I mean, that seems like the biggest black bugaboo word. But I was really intrigued today to see in the news that Google? Anyway, two big companies, including BP, have actually opted out of ALEC, that Legislative Exchange Council that the Koch brothers run, because of climate. So it seems like some of these people that we assume are, you know, don't get it, maybe they are really beginning to get it now, which I found, again, hopeful, you know.
And I like the idea also of reconciliation. You know, I certainly don't believe in violence, and I believe that ultimately we are all interconnected, and that understanding is essentially people who have that understanding, it's their responsibility to express that attitude. And those who haven't figured that out yet will, in a sense, you know, they are undergoing their own, if you want to say, karma, or, you know, doing unto others. All of us have that ultimate responsibility. We can do what we can to let others know about that. And So if people are being abusive, they need to be called out on that. But done in, I would say, positive ways, but forceful ways.
We have another caller, Natano. What would you like to talk about?
Yeah, I was just curious if you guys ever did any, or if you knew of any study that showed what we could do with like a 500-watt windmill on every telephone pole, because I think if we did that, we'd power half of the country on any given day, and then the other half of the energy equation is megawatts. We waste 50% of the energy we generate, so this whole notion that we need more nuclear plants that Obama is planning and more coal extraction is kind of ludicrous if you look at the real easy and low-cost solutions to these problems. Plus, if you did that, massive decentralization of wind power, create a lot of jobs.
How about it, Jesse? Wind power's on every telephone pole.
I love the idea, and certainly megawatts is a really smart idea. This is something where people can sign up voluntarily to essentially have their, for example, a large office building will contract with the utility. Of course, the utility now is more of a service entity rather than a supply entity. And they contract with the utility to, at a certain peaking point, to to shut off the air conditioning for 20 minutes where they won't even notice it, but it allows for the utility to manage these peaks so that there's less large-scale base load that needs to be constantly running just to handle these peaks. So megawatts has already been implemented in many parts of the country, and it is an increasing source of essentially grid efficiency. And I agree that while I think Obama has certainly been positive on many aspects, he extended the tax credit for solar and wind that was implemented under George Bush, at which point in 2005 we did see the largest essentially ramping up of these technologies. So, you know, all parties are involved in this, whatever your political stance is. But, yeah, having nuclear is definitely not the solution. And this, unfortunately, again, nuclear has been a divisive point in the past. I would say that that debate finally is really coming to an end. There's been a concern by really sincere and knowledgeable environmentalists that we have to have nuclear in order to replace fossil fuels, and if we don't, we're doomed, essentially.
And you're saying that's not the case.
Well, last year we're seeing, even in China, which has the largest plan for increase in nuclear, their wind and solar is outpacing their nuclear. And if you look at the cost, it is just it's a smarter investment. There's less end-of-life costs, shall we say, because we have no idea what the end-of-life costs of nuclear are going to be.
And we only have a few minutes left. I wanted to get to, like, how people listening can even just get involved in this. Like, for instance, I know there was a Stand Up to Oil coalition that met in Salem yesterday to, it's all part of a, that's not it. It was a clean energy rally in Salem, because people are trying to get a bill passed in Salem for clean energy right now, and a lot of environmental groups were involved in that. The Stand Up to Oil coalition has to do with something going on in Vancouver, where apparently Vancouver, Southwest Washington, is like sort of a target for maybe the largest natural gas export facility in America right now, and people are wanting to stop that. Of course, there's always these divestment campaigns, the Oregon Climate Declaration. Do you have any other things that, and then the Keep It in the Ground, there's a lot of actions around that, the Keep It in the Ground movement, the the Guardian in England, the 350 org. But what are some of the things that you're seeing going on, Jesse?
Those are all fantastic, Stephanie. I would just say everybody should put some time into this. It takes a lot of, I would say, not just time effort, it takes emotional effort to look at these problems. I mean, it's kind of sometimes overwhelming, but if you spend enough time in it, you also can be encouraged. And the more people that get involved, the more those feelings of encouragement for the individual raise. So there's always something that someone can do, whether it's on your home level of efficiency. And I would say that's part of it, but there should also be pressure towards calling your state and federal representatives, and that should be part of it, but you should get involved with a group and, you know, pick and choose your groups, study it, see which ones really make the best sense in terms of the science. Keep your mind open. And I would also like to just point out that there may be some who feel threatened by this transition. That's natural, because we are essentially in Jacobson's plans. There's about 7.5 million jobs that would be created by this transition, but they would replace about 3.5 million lost jobs. And that's important. Those people who essentially would be impacted negatively by this transition, there needs to be some form of either compensation through job retraining, and
you're talking like coal miners, for instance, would lose their jobs.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. They should be involved in the energy transition, and because they've been providing energy in the past, they shouldn't be demonized as bad guys. And this also applies to people who work in biofuels. They have have provided energy. However, the transition needs to move towards something that is not just sustainable, but restorative.
And totally clean, as clean as possible.
Yeah, and because the consequences are absolutely traumatic. I mean, this is something where we have the largest environmental groups, the largest NGOs, and now the largest governmental agencies are saying that the risks are absolutely catastrophic.
Even the Pentagon. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
People should be involved in one way or the other. Those groups that you mentioned are all fantastic. But, you know, everybody should do something, and they'll be glad they did.
Yeah, well, their children can have a planet to live on, and the grandchildren.
Yeah.
I want to just let listeners know, and Jesse, I want to thank you for being on with us. This has been Jesse Hunter, a solar consultant, a renewable energy guy, talking about why there's still a lot more to do, but we may have crossed the Rubicon in terms of getting ourselves on track with renewable energy. A lot of developments are happening out there. It's just check it out on the web. There's just so much going on. This is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. The engineer has been Tammy Dean. Thank you, Tammy. And I'm Stephanie Potter, your host. Thanks for listening.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, March 25, 2015. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, Oregon's Department of Justice opened an investigation into the over $11 million in tax credits that were awarded to Oregon State University and the Oregon Institute of Technology for the installation of a series of solar arrays. It was reported by the Oregonian and Oregonian Live last month that deadlines were missed for qualifying.
Redmond-based WiseRG is planning to introduce a machine that turns food waste into liquid fertilizer in Portland and Northern California. The company has mastered the technology.